Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Beautiful day out there. Crisp. Is it still blue sky? Well, I think as probably most of you know, I recently came back from a month-long retreat, kind of a solo retreat. And it was wonderful. And it was challenging, both at the same time. Taking care of a house for a couple that have another house in the Canary Islands. And it was near the water, so I could walk out to the ocean and to the beach, kind of almost a kind of a private beach, because there was private houses that kind of lined all the way along, but I could walk out there. It's very quiet, and it was close enough I could get a few groceries now and again when I needed to. There was a store not too far away. But I would go there onto the beach almost every day, and in the first part of my month, I saw sea lions on a rock, kind of way out there. And then they disappeared, but throughout the retreat, I saw seals. They would pop up their heads, half a dozen or so, watch me as I walked up and down the beach to get some exercise. So it was pretty beautiful. It was very beautiful. And then, of course, it snowed a few times. And my typical schedule would be, you know, get up, sit. I sit around 6 hours, for about 6 hours every day, and do some calligraphy, cook my meals, clean up, go for a walk, repeat, kind of day after day, and some study as well. And I didn't talk with anybody. I just, except for Kate, I would call once a week on the phone, and we'd talk. And then, you know, aside from the person who operated the cash register at the store, that's the only person I would say a few words to. So it was also, for me, a time of deep silence, which I would highly recommend. A silence where you don't speak, but also a silence where I wasn't really engaged in you know, emails. I basically stopped using my emails except once a week, stopped, you know, looking at the internet, that kind of thing. And yet, after a few days of this, into my retreat, I noticed something really interesting about what I was doing. I had kind of made my retreat into a project. And the goal of this project was to follow the schedule and get from here, where I was, into somewhere else. Got that sense right now, you want to get something. And so I wasn't clear what that was. I didn't have a clear kind of destination in mind, aside from, of course, awakening. But I noticed within me kind of a drive to get somewhere that was more, it was something extra added on to the discipline of just getting up at 5 and, you know, starting to sit and doing the schedule. There was something more there. I also noticed I was evaluating. Was that a good sit? Maybe not so good sit. Is this enough food? Maybe it's too much. Maybe it's not quite enough. Enough sleep, or maybe too much sleep. And it's true, while, you know, evaluation is important, in my case, I saw it as a kind of fuel to this kind of struggle of meeting whatever that nebulous goal was that seemed to be tucked away somewhere in my head. And I also noticed that the project aspect, you know, getting this, having this project aspect, clouded my capacity to be present. Now, really, none of this is new or unexpected, really. But this month-long retreat really allowed me to see it clearly, to see how this practice, even my practice, can be a kind of selfing, making myself into a good Zen student, you know, doing a good retreat. And so constantly throughout the retreat, I was unhooking from those kind of ghostly goals that seemed to be there somewhere, unhooking from expectations that would arise, and unhooking from criticisms, you know, not quite there, not doing it right, more of this, less of that. Unhooking. It's interesting, you know, we use our practice, we can use our practice to really make ourself, you know, kind of a selfing project. When we begin Zazen, we begin our meditation on the cushion, I think we can begin to start recognizing this habit of selfing, of making ourselves into something better, into something fixed. Our sense of brokenness, after all, is really what often leads us to this practice in the first place, to making the commitment to come to the Zendo. And it is true, we need discipline. We need a steadiness. But our practice itself will become a source of suffering if we make it into another kind of self-improvement project. And even though I've been doing this for a long time, that tendency is still there. So I encourage us all to kind of recognize that we need to be aware of this. Zazen is our fundamental way of letting go of our stories, of what needs to be repaired, and how to get there. We sit down, we still the body, and bring our attention to our breath by following the in and out of the breath, sometimes counting. And if or as the mind settles, we might then just rest in the settled mind itself, letting go of breath, letting go of counting. And this is the practice I believe Dogen calls shikantaza, just sitting in deep total presence, but with awareness and carefully observing what arises without any engagement with it at all, returning to the stillness. And in this way, we shift from the act of selfing to what we may call presencing. Not trying to get somewhere else, just here. Just this. Now, last weekend, I led a retreat on a piece of writing by Dogen called Radiant Light. Some of you were here for that. And two passages from that piece of writing go like this. Dogen wrote, and Dogen, I think almost everyone here probably knows Dogen, but he was the Japanese priest who brought this style of practice from China to Japan way back in the 1200s. So, here, words of Dogen. The entire world of the ten directions is the radiant light of the self. Study that radiant light is the self of the entire world of the ten directions. The entire world of the ten directions is the self. This self is the entire world of the ten directions. There's no way to avoid it. Now, much could be said about these two passages that I just quoted here. But Dogen is telling us, you, me, right here, right now, we are whole and complete. That you are so thoroughly woven into the fabric of this flowing and dynamic universe that there's no way to separate you from this universe, from all that surrounds you. There's no way, ultimately, no way to separate you from the seals I saw off the Sunshine Coast, or the hummingbirds that are braving the winter here. This selfing, or self-centeredness, is perhaps our main and most tenacious problem, both on and off the cushion. But there is help. Here's another quote from Dogen, and then I'm going to follow it by a comment by Shohaku Okumura, who is a Japanese Zen priest and scholar, now teaching in Bloomington, Indiana. And he was the first Zen teacher that Kate and I studied with when we lived in Kyoto. So anyway, here's the quote first from Dogen. Those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded in realization are living beings. In other words, like you and me. Let me read this one more time. Those who greatly realize delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded in realization are living beings. That's a quote from another piece of writing by Dogen, very famous, called Genjo Koan. Anyway, so here's Shohaku Okumura's comment on that. Shohaku writes, if we are truly honest and sincere with ourselves, we will find that no matter how hard we practice, our motivation for practice is still based in some amount of self-centeredness. There's always going to be some amount of self-centeredness. Dogen said that those who recognize this self-centeredness, this self-centered base of their practice, those who recognize this are Buddhas. Our practice, the awakening that allows us to see our own self-centeredness and letting go of it, is Buddha. Isn't that a bit of relief? When we can see our own self-centeredness, we are acting as Buddhas. It's not that we need to kill it. We need to see it. Hello, self-centered Michael. So our Zazen is training for facing and letting go of our own self-centeredness on the cushion. Right? Over and over again, following breath, drifting off into fantasy, memories, worries. Back. At that moment is a moment of being Buddha. But what about off the cushion? How do we practice with the everydayness of brushing teeth, cooking, cleaning up the dishes? During my retreat, this was really, really important for me. In the Zen tradition, and especially in our Soto Zen tradition, the everyday activities are seen as Dharma gates and should be approached with great mindfulness and integrity. We all tend to emphasize, you know, Zazen practice, our meditation practice. And then, you know, we get up and get on with the nitty-gritty of our daily lives. But really, that's a mistake. So here's another quote by Dogen, this time from a work called The Ehe Shingi. And it's a short piece of a short talk that he gave his monastics, the people who were practicing with him. It's kind of cute, I think. Dogen, speaking to his students, he says, "Entering the water without avoiding deep sea dragons is the courage of a fisherman. Traveling the earth without avoiding tigers is the courage of a hunter. Facing the drawn sword before you and seeing death as just like life is the courage of a general. What is the courage of patch-robed monks like you guys?" So I may rephrase that in this case. I may ask you, what is the courage of a layperson attending Sunday morning at a Zen center? What is the courage there? And after a pause, and in these Zen stories, the monks almost never respond because whatever they're going to respond is not going to be quite right. So after a pause, then Dogen responds, right? Dogen gives the answer like teachers do. He said, "Spread out your bedding and sleep. Set out your bowls and eat rice. Exhale through your nostrils. Radiate light from your eyes. With vitality, eat lots of rice and then use the toilet." He goes on a little bit, but you get the idea. In this passage, Dogen is inspiring his listeners and inspiring us to bring integrity and care and attentive caring to all activities, not dividing up our lives into the sacred and the profane, the special and the mundane. For example, another famous work by Dogen called the Tenzo Kyoken, Instructions to the Cook, Dogen writes about taking care of the kitchen, the utensils in the kitchen. He tells this is the instructions to the cook. "Wash them so they are completely pure and clean, placing high up those that belong in high places and putting down low those that belong in low places. Treat utensils, such as tongs and ladles and all other implements and ingredients, with equal respect. Handle all things with sincerity, picking up and putting them down with courtesy." Isn't that lovely? Pick up your soup ladle with courtesy and put it down. This teaching was very helpful for me. Almost every day during my retreat, I hauled several wheelbarrows of wood up to the wood box by the house. And wood was my main source of heat when I was staying in this place. And I really enjoyed the activity and was grateful for the exercise because it kept me warm, loading the wood and hauling it up, and then also the fire, so I get warm twice. And I cleaned up very carefully after each meal, putting everything back in its place. And I put away all my study materials when I studied. And put everything away when it was time to cook or time to do zazen. These activities helped keep me present, as did a regular cleaning of the house. I took great care to keep the kitchen and the bathroom in proper condition. As you probably know, Zen temples and monasteries are famous for being immaculate, especially the toilet and the bathhouse. They're separate. In Western culture, the toilet or bathroom tends to be regarded as a kind of unfortunate necessity, right? Often referred to using euphemisms, although that's changing. But in Japan, historically, the toilet has been a sacred place. And to kind of illustrate that, I think Kate has a story she could share. Be willing to share the sacredness of the toilet. Okay,
this is the humorous interlude in this Dharma talk. Perhaps
kind of like a no play, like in between a no play, they have
get the kyogen.
Kyogen, which.
So this might be a little unsuitable, but bear with me. Okay, so Michael and I. So Kyoto is really hot and humid in the summertime. So we would go often north to the mountains, and this time we went to Hokkaido, the northern island of Japan, traveled by train and bus with our packs. And we went to the farthest northeastern peninsula. It's called the Shiretoko Hanto. There's a national park there, and it's really, really beautiful. And we decided that we would hike up to a mountain pass and down the other side, essentially across this narrow peninsula, down to the highway, down to the road again. And then the plan was that we would hitchhike to a place where we had reserved to stay, a minshiku, kind of a Japanese B&B, except you get your dinner and your breakfast. And we would meet up with friends of ours who were traveling by car, American friends, a couple who were traveling with a Japanese couple. It was a beautiful day, and we had a wonderful hike, except that when we just about were to the top of the pass, we turned around and saw huge thunder clouds looming, and within moments, we were in the midst of a pretty dramatic thunderstorm. Thunder, lightning, torrential rain. So we took cover under a boulder, overhanging boulder, for probably an hour. And the worst of the thunder and lightning passed. Time was moving on. We had a destination, so we pretty much had to continue walking in the rain. We got quite wet, but eventually the rain stopped. We made it to the highway, got a ride, arrived at the destination. It was at a little inn owned by a family who were fisher people, specializing in crab fishing. We had a wonderful meal. Our gear got very, very wet. My wallet was in the top pocket of the pack, so I laid out the contents of my wallet. In Japan still, but very much then, was a cash economy, so you carried large amounts of cash wherever you went, along with your train ticket and your alien registration card. So all this stuff was pretty wet, so I laid it out to dry in the room. And the next morning, I packed it all back in my wallet, still slightly wet, damp, and put it in my back pocket of my shorts. We went down, had a delicious breakfast, and then I went to the washroom. The washroom was a squat toilet, which is common in Japan, less so now. And what we would call a pit toilet. It was a concrete pit sunk into the ground. I went. I got up. I heard a sploosh.
No. No.
My wallet. With a considerable amount of cash, the return train ticket, and the alien registration card was in the depths. I had put it in my pocket so that I could pay our bill after we had breakfast. So I had to go back in, confess to Michael and our friends.
Quite distraught.
but well contained.
Michael!
So I went up to the woman at the cash register, and I said in my very most polite Japanese, "I'm really, really sorry, but I just dropped my wallet down the toilet." And she said, "Oh, don't worry. Somebody else did that just a week ago. We had it pumped out recently. Don't worry, it'll be fine." And the whole family then mobilized into action. The husband, the young husband, went to a shed and brought back one of those trouble lights, like at a garage. He took off the porcelain fixture and lowered the trouble light down. And the grandfather went and got a claw-like implement, maybe for catching crabs, I don't know. And he lashed a broomstick onto it to make it longer. And then he had a basin lined in newspaper to receive the object. And he put the claw-like tool down, swooshed around, brought it up. "Is that it?" "No." Tried again. Pulled it up. "Is that it?" "I'm not sure." One more time. And he got it. Brought it up, deposited it in the basin. The grandpa took the basin to the fish cleaning shack where there was a big vat of hot water. He, rubber gloves, took it out, took the wallet, opened out the wallet, laid it on a piece of sheet metal, all the contents, splooshed it off with the hot water. The coins didn't look good. And then laid it all out neatly, took it out into the yard. The young mother with her baby on her back in a sling came out with a hairdryer on an extension cord and dried it all off for me, and then sprayed it with a perfume atomizer. All as though this is the most natural thing in the world to do. And then he handed me the wallet, and I said, "Oh, I can't pay you with this money. I was going to pay our bill, but I can't pay you with this money now. Is there a way we can, like, go into the town and, you know, to the bank and then come back?" And he said, "Oh, no. Oh, no. This is a special wallet now. And this is special money because it's been to the underworld and back. And we honor the toilet. We have a god of the toilet and a kami of the toilet. And little children, when they get big enough, when they're toddlers, are taken and introduced to the god of the toilet so that they will be careful in their toileting. And anything that returns and from the toilet is lucky, is good fortune." So he was happy to receive that money. And I was incredibly moved by this experience about how this simple kindness and generosity towards a foreigner, and with utter just kind of matter-of-factness, earthiness. And so I've had a soft spot in my heart for the god of the toilet ever since. And last time we were in Japan, we were out in the countryside at an inn where we stayed, and they were selling little images of the god of the toilet. So there's one that sits on our toilet at home, and we were going to bring it, but we forgot. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Over to Michael.
Thank you. So, in Japan, particularly in households, toilets are kept impeccably clean. This is true also, of course, in monasteries. In fact, there's a maxim in Japanese that goes something like, toire wa sono ika no kao. So the restroom or the toilet is the face of the house. So you know, you present your best, your face, right? So that's very, very clean. And I think Dogen would agree that the toilet or the toilet room is the face of the monastery. We keep that really clean. He wrote in a collection of essays called the Shobogenzo, one essay called Senjo, which translates as perhaps washing or cleansing or cleaning. And here in this essay, Dogen gives very meticulous instructions on personal hygiene, how to brush your teeth, etc., including, though, how to use the toilet. And in reading it over, I was amazed at how some of these instructions could still be applied today, and certainly amongst the SFU students where I used to teach. I think they could take note as well. So here, let me read you a little passage from this, Senjo, about using a toilet. After entering the toilet, you should lift and gather up your underskirt by its corners, face the door, and straddle the basin between your feet. Squat down and relieve yourself. Do not soil either side of your garments. Do not soil the front or back of the toilet. How many of you have been in public toilets? And during this time, you should remain silent. Do not talk or joke with the person in the next stall. Do not chant, sing, or recite anything aloud. Do not spit or blow mucus from your nose into the area around you. Do not strain or make grunting noises. Do not write on the walls. You should not dig or draw on the ground with your toilet stick. It should be used for cleaning yourself after you have evacuated your bowels. So they had sticks, these sticks that you would use for cleaning yourself. Also, if you use paper, you should not use old paper or paper with writing on it. You should keep in mind the difference between a clean toilet stick and a soiled one. The toilet stick is 8 inches long, triangular in shape, in thickness about the width of one's thumb. As I have seen some translations translate this as a shit stick or spatula. That's what was used for cleaning oneself. Some are lacquered and some are not. Put your soiled spatula, your soiled toilet stick, in the used toilet stick box. Clean ones will already be in the toilet stick stand. The toilet stick stand is kept near the front of the toilet basin. And so for further details, and there's more, I direct you to Senjo, chapter 7 of the Shobogenzo, and you can read much more detail about the proper way to use the toilet. A little bit earlier in the same chapter, this Senjo chapter about personal hygiene, Dogen presents a deeply moving passage about the connection between practice and opening to the unity of all things. He wrote, "At just the moment when we dignify mind and body with training, the timeless and original practice is complete and fully realized. Thus, the body and mind of this practice manifests itself in its original pure state." So when we practice, he says, we're already there. That moment of practice is already a moment of awakening. Right? Kind of very profound kind of Dogen statement. And then the very next sentence reads, "Cut your 10 fingernails." The 10 fingernails means all your nails, and cut your toenails in the same manner. So Senjo, this text, contains much practical information and instructions, but it's also includes very kind of sweeping statements about the nature of reality. And while it's very important, of course, to have good hygiene, especially when living in community, Dogen cautions us in this chapter not to create a line between our practice in the Zendo and the reality of our body, the use and care of the body and the buildings and everything else that surrounds us. There's no difference on and off the cushion. It's all sacred. And if we operate in this way, it will always bring us back into this present moment. Here, fully alive, our life exactly as it is. In the same chapter, this Senjo chapter, Dogen also includes another way, or another action, another way to help us remain mindful in our daily activities. And this is with the use of gathas, or of very short poems when we do an activity. So here are a few gathas. I think just one or two of them are from the Senjo, but gathas are used in Zen monasteries to bring mindfulness, particularly for care of the body. And Susan, we remember some of these perhaps because we chanted them at Tassajara. So here are some examples. "When using the toilet, I vow with all beings to eliminate defilement, removing greed, hate, and delusion. Or the entering the bath first. Bathing the body, may all living beings be clean in body and mind, pure and shining within and without." Isn't that beautiful? Recite that as you before you hop in the shower, take a bath. "Holding the toothbrush, may all living beings attain the true Dharma and be naturally pure and clean." Of course, in Dogen's days, they didn't have toothbrushes. They used twigs to chew on. You would chew and kind of use, and then use that to kind of clean your mouth. "Upon washing the face with water, I pray that all living beings may gain the pure Dharma gate and be forever without defilement." So these verses, these gathas, and I encourage you to make up your own, can be really helpful for us, kind of shifting from selfing to presencing. So how do we return to presencing in our daily life as we do our activities? Well, we take care. We take care of the body, we take care of the things around us with full attention and kindness. And as Dogen says, courtesy. We bring our awareness to our hands as they clean, cook, fold clothes, pick up, neaten. We take joy in placing what goes in a high place, in a high place, and what goes in a low place, in a low place. We take care for and we thank our tools. We slow down. Not acting hastily, we let the body fully accomplish what needs to be done. So throughout my month-long retreat, I struggled with my subtle and at times not so subtle tendency to make the retreat into a project. Have a goal, evaluate. Over and over again, I had to unhook myself in the same way that we unhook ourselves when we do zazen. I think this is the way of our practice, unhooking and returning to the fullness of our life as it is, opening to and trusting its boundless nature. Thank you for listening.